Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the sudden summit with North Korea's Kim Jong-un, announced by Donald Trump, that is to take place in May at a place yet to be determined. Already Trump has covered his bets by saying, quote, "I may leave fast or we may sit down and make the greatest deal in the world." Sung-Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, joins us to discuss Trump's claim about the North Koreans that, quote, "I think they want to make peace. I think it's time," and how much that seems to miss the point that Kim's primary goal is the perpetuation of his family's cruel and criminal regime. We'll also speculate about the seesawing diplomacy underway with an about-face from having Vice President Pence getting stiffed by the North Korean delegation at the Winter Olympics to Kim Jong-un's invitation for a summit with Trump delivered to the White House by South Korea's National Security Advisor and the head of South Korea's intelligence service after their recent meeting with Kim, which followed the thawing of relations between the North and the South on display at the Winter Olympics. Then we'll examine further the fast-track war to peace change from Trump threatening Little Rocket Man with fire and fury to quickly deciding to be the only prominent American, apart from Dennis Rodman, to meet with Kim Jong-un, an American who happens to be the President of the United States. Kent Harrington, a former senior CIA analyst who served as the National Intelligence Officer for East Asia, joins us to discuss the unusual approach to international diplomacy underway with a former builder of skyscrapers starting construction on the penthouse before he has laid the foundations. Then finally, we'll look into the growing legal jeopardy Trump has from his pre-election cover-up of an affair with Stormy Daniels and the $130,000 payoff his lawyer made to the porn star, along with an NDA, which could soon be broken. Nina Burley, the national politics correspondent at Newsweek, joins us to discuss her article, "Stormy Breaks Trump's Favorite Legal Tactic, the NDA," and her cover article at Newsweek, "The Star Mangled Banner, Can the American Legal System Survive Donald Trump?" And joining us now is Sung-Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sung-Yoon Lee.
Thank you for having me.
So let's go straight to the question that I raised there in the introduction. What do you think happened between that moment at the Winter Olympics where Vice President Pence was stiffed by the North Korean delegation and, of course, Kim's sister being prominent there, sitting behind him, stone-faced, or both of them were stone-faced. And then shortly thereafter, you have this extraordinary meeting in the Oval Office where the South Korean head of intelligence and National Security Advisor were over in the Executive Office Building briefing the National Security Council. Trump heard about it, called them into the Oval Office after a brief discussion where they told him that Kim wanted to have a summit with Trump. Trump instantly agreed on the spot, which absolutely floored the South Koreans and most of the world for that matter. So I think that's a brief sketch of what happened. So what happened between those two events?
Well, if we rewind a bit further to early January, it's hard to imagine that Kim Jong-un woke up on New Year's Day and had a moment of epiphany and decided heretofore he's going to be a nice guy. All this has been premeditated. It's been planned probably for years. Why? Because North Korea had a triumphant year in 2017, a year-long constant bluster, threats, provocations, and unprecedented success with three intercontinental ballistic missile tests and the most powerful hydrogen bomb test to date for that nation. So it's time to switch gears, put on the charm offensive, and call the shots. In Pyeongchang at the Winter Games, North Korea ignored the vice president because Mike Pence had said a lot of things in the days leading up to that encounter at the opening ceremony on February 9th, which carry great validity. For example, North Korea's outreach is all a ploy. Charade is the word that the vice president used, that we have to maintain maximum pressure. North Korea is a criminal regime that starves its people. All those messages need to be repeated, but not necessarily at the Olympic Games, where positive thinking trumps reality. It's all about feeling good, and this is the world's biggest festival. So the U.S. delegation, led by the vice president, came across as grumpy, not very good at PR, while the North Korean head of the delegation, the real de facto chief, of course, the royal sister, a young woman, Miss Kim, Kim Yo-jong, just by flashing that strange, mysterious, imperious smile and acting normal, came across as the more attractive party, the party more interested in seeking peace. So the real question that I have is, now that President Trump has shown his eagerness even to be engaged by the Kim regime, what happened at what point between Mike Pence's invalidation of Kim Jong-un's Pyeongchang Olympics outreach in early February as a charade, and Kim Jong-un's courting of President Trump just a few days ago in early March? You know, when did the dear leader's intentions become not fake?
Well, but Trump has called Kim Little Rocket Man and threatened him with fire and fury. And in return, Kim Jong-un has referred to Trump as a mentally deranged U.S. dotard. So it's not as if you say that Pence has made some indelicate and undiplomatic remarks, which may have soured the possibility of a summit. But Trump has certainly taken it even further. So what happened? Why is Kim Jong-un prepared to bury the hatchet?
Because it's in his interest. What Kim Jong-un is doing in suddenly reaching out to Donald Trump, he is simply taking a page out of his daddy's playbook. Back in 2000, Kim II, Kim Jong-il, the father of the current youthful despot, he held the first ever inter-Korean summit with the South Korean president, who paid Kim Jong-il secretly, illegally, $500 million, literally in the days leading up to that meeting in June. And then, having successfully tamed South Korea, Kim turned to taming, softening up Washington. And in early October, for the first time, and this was truly unprecedented, North Korea sent a special envoy to President Bill Clinton, who carried the invitation for a Pyongyang visit by Clinton. President Clinton was actually keen on traversing that trap-strewn path to Pyongyang, but was sort of spared, unwittingly saved the embarrassment by the George W. Bush-Al Gore election recount fiasco, which really dragged on until mid-December, until Al Gore conceded defeat. But in the meantime, Clinton sent his Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, just 3 weeks after meeting with the North Korean envoy. And Albright was hastily dispatched to Pyongyang in late October. And there she was toasting Kim Jong-un's health, sitting side by side with Kim Jong-un, watching a grand spectacle, the mass games, which is the most spectacular manifestation of totalitarianism in the world. The optics were not really good, and Clinton ran out of time. So this outreach invitation to meet is not unprecedented, and it's in the North Korean playbook.
Well, there's no question that Bill Clinton was distracted at the very end, actually trying to pull off a deal with the Israelis and Palestinians as well. And I'm sure that also contributed to why that went nowhere. But that's not to say, surely, that the current regime in South Korea, President Moon's regime, have they made a secret payment? I mean, the fact that the matter is that the envoys who came to the White House, who also met with Kim in Pyongyang, are the National Security Advisor and the head of South Korea's intelligence service. Neither of those are naive people, are they?
The head of the National Intelligence Service, the counterpart of the CIA, has been deeply involved in two previous inter-Korean summit meetings, the first one in 2000, as I mentioned, which entailed money flow of $500 million. To put that in context, that was approximately $500 million was approximately North Korea's total export earnings for that year. So that was a lot of money for North Korea. And then there was another meeting in 2007, another summit, and Mr. Seo, the head of the NIS, was deeply involved in that too. He's very experienced. His colleague, Mr. Chung, Ambassador Chung, is a Korea diplomat, a very reserved, prudent kind of person. But they, of course, were riding on the waves, the triumph of having met Kim Jong-un just a few days before on Monday, and Kim Jong-un's great hospitality. Everyone who has visited Pyongyang and met with the North Korean leader comes away impressed. And one reason is because our expectations, you know, the standards, are rather low because they come across as so bizarre and even crazy. But everyone says of Kim Jong-il or his father, the founder, and the current leader, they are smart, you know, knowledgeable. Of course they're going to be knowledgeable. They don't just show up to meetings without preparation. They're charismatic. Of Kim Jong-un, the South Korean envoy said on return home to South Korea, Kim Jong-un is sincere and bold, as in manly and trustworthy. So, you know, all this is good in the meantime, and there is the chance that everything will pan out very well, but I think it's far more likely, once again, the U.S. and South Korea will be played by Pyongyang.
And again, I'm speaking with Sung-Yoon Lee, who is a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University and a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. So at the end of the day, though, obviously what the Kim regime does wants is the perpetuation of this cruel and criminal regime. This is a family kleptocracy. They have such control over the country and not just over its people and its resources, but they also have control over the minds of the people. North Korean parents can't express love to their children and vice versa, nor can anybody express any love except for the dear leader. That is their entire focus, and they've pulled off an extraordinary situation. It's beyond belief how they managed to control that country and starve the people while building nuclear weapons and missiles, etc. So my understanding has always been that the real Achilles heel with this regime is South Korean soap operas that are smuggled in, where the people actually in North Korea see that there is another world outside of this hermit kingdom bubble that's imposed on them by ubiquitous propaganda. So if that's the only way to undo the Kim regime and to free the Korean people, the North Korean people, then surely this deal with Trump, because Trump's completely transactional, he has no concern about human rights or any values beyond making himself look good, then at the end of the day, aren't the North Korean people going to be, their imprisonment will be perpetuated?
The prospects for success are rather dim. And speaking of human rights violation, Ms. Kim, the first sister, Kim Yo-jong, you know what her day job is? She is the head of North Korea's key ministry, the Department of Propaganda and Agitation. She's the royal censor. Her job is to make sure that fellow North Koreans remain in the dark, systematically deprived of even the most basic information about the outside world, so that her criminal family can maintain its power in perpetuity. But she is a new weapon for North Korea. Hers is a softer, a feminine, kinder, even quasi-glamorous human face on the very unattractive, inhumane, and mockable regime that is the North Korean state. So don't be surprised if the Pyongyang princess, who is reportedly pregnant, in the coming weeks at some point makes the Trans-Pacific trip looking visibly pregnant and really boondoggling the world. Well-wishers would say, oh, look at this hardworking, self-sacrificing, peace-seeking envoy, and please listen to her entreaty, Mr. Trump, and go and meet her card-playing, war-threatening brother. Now, the U.S. really has to do a lot more to send more information into North Korea, and so should South Korea. The fundings for these Korean language services, radio transmission, are paltry. In fact, the U.S. funding for Korean services for Voice of America and Radio Free Asia are lower, they're less, than the funds available for Burmese, Tibetan, and Indonesian languages. All important issues, of course, but come on, North Korea, according to the UN, is without parallel when it comes to crimes against humanity.
So are the North Korean people informed about this offer of a summit with Trump?
Probably not yet, but at some point they will announce it and they will package it as a tributary mission in the grand Chinese imperial style. And that's fine, you know, they can dub it how they want to. But here's the thing. Why is Kim Jong-un reaching out to the U.S. leader? Well, because he wants the U.S. and South Korea to take the leading role in relaxing, weakening this global sanctions regime that's finally been built up so that he can buy more time and money with which to perfect his own nuclear strategy, to roll out his own nuclear posture review at a time of his choosing. He has already bought a free pass, in my view, for the next big provocation, which has to come at some point because of this momentum, this, you know, air of atmospherics of rapprochement that's already been built up. And some sanctions relaxation will have to precede the actual face-to-face meeting. But that is the wrong approach. Mr. Trump must realize that by law, you know, the gradual suspension and ultimate termination of U.S. sanctions against North Korea are codified in the sanctions legislation that was signed into law by Obama 2 years ago. Unless North Korea takes meaningful steps toward the complete dismantlement of its nuclear plants, unless North Korea stops illicit activities like counterfeiting and money laundering and proliferation, unless North Korea releases all political prisoners and stops censoring its people, the U.S. is legally bound to continue to enforce sanctions, no matter how good, no matter how bonumous the moment of the summitry might be.
Well, just in the last minute, is Donald Trump correct in claiming that the pressure he's put on North Korea by these ramped-up sanctions have done the trick?
I think that self-congratulation, I wouldn't say it's completely irrelevant because it is true. Trump gets credit for really enforcing sanctions in a meaningful way. None of his predecessors ever did that. But come on, the learning curve has been a bit slow. It must be a factor. Kim probably feels the pinch, but not to the point of fearing destabilization, a coup d'etat, or anything like that. And you would have to come to that kind of critical point for Kim to recalculate his interests and even begin seriously to think about denuclearization. Notice how Kim so far has made no concession whatsoever. He purportedly said now he's amenable to denuclearization talks and he won't conduct any more nuclear and missile tests in the meantime. Excuse me, these activities are banned, prohibited by more than 10 UN Security Council resolutions. So the mere utterance of abstinence from forbidden activities is no concession at all.
Well, Sung-Yoon Lee, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Sung-Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University and a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining further the fast-track war to peace change from Trump threatening Little Rocket Man with fire and fury to quickly deciding to join Kim Jong-un in a summit meeting in May. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kent Harrington, who's a former senior CIA analyst who serves as a national intelligence officer for East Asia and as chief of station in Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kent Harrington.
Good morning, Ian. It's good to talk to you.
Well, thanks, Kent. And our previous guest was pointing out that this is not unprecedented, an offer of a summit between a North Korean leader and an American president. In 2000, Kim Jong-il sent his vice marshal, Yeo Myung-rok, the highest military man in the country, to visit Bill Clinton in October of 2000. And Madeleine Albright went over there. And, of course, at the last minute, President Clinton got more preoccupied with trying to pull off a deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and that went nowhere. But what Sung Yoon Lee said to us was that a minute ago that the South Koreans sweetened the offer with a $500 million payment to the North as a precursor for this opening. And the very person involved in this recent trip to Pyongyang, the South Korean head of the South Korean intelligence service, was one of the people that facilitated that $500 million payment. So, is there any bribes going on at the moment?
Good question. I don't think I'd bet against that being a very strong possibility. But the professor's point is a very good one. The Korean intelligence service, under its various acronyms going back to KCIA days, has always been at the center of contacts with the North, and it's been in large part the repository of knowledge about the North, both because of its collection and also its analytical work. And I would simply add to what you just summarized that it was the KCIA's leadership that was instrumental in the very beginning of North-South contacts and discussions under President Park Chung-hee in 1970. They played a leading role in every element of the dialogue under Park after his assassination. They played a similar role under No Tae-woo when he was president. And indeed, even into the Democratic Party, the more reformist administrations in the 1990s. So it's not surprising that they should play this role. They are a protected channel, so to speak, and well known to the other side. I think the key question here is, what is the alignment inside the South Korean government behind President Moon? He has largely purged from the ranks of the senior intelligence services, people who have been aligned with his conservative opposition. And I would suspect that at this point, with one of South Korea's goals under President Moon achieved, which is the opening of a dialogue, which he has pressed for over many years during his career, a dialogue with the North, that he has the support inside his own administration, certainly, to move ahead. It's an objective that the North Koreans, I think, have successfully capitalized on. They know it doesn't get any better than this when it comes to South Korean leadership, and Moon's desire to have a dialogue is a very helpful interest on the South Korean side for the North. It's important really to remember that this very, very long history of contacts between North and South is really the playing field we're on when the United States goes to deal with an issue, even one that we've made as high a priority as denuclearization of North Korea. We are only one of three players in this game on the peninsula, and I'm not even getting to the alliance relationships around it. So I would simply say there's lots of things going on between North and South that are independent of us, and the politics of that issue are extraordinarily important going forward.
Well, that probably explains why the Prime Minister of Japan, Abe, is coming over here to meet with Trump. I think he's quite nervous and wants to weigh in on this issue. But today on Fox News Sunday, the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, Mike Pompeo, said President Trump isn't doing this for theater. He's going to solve a problem. That's not, a lot of people don't think that's the case. They think that Trump is transactional, ego-driven, and is basically running the White House like a reality TV show and desperately wants a win at the moment. He's got a porn star breathing down his back.
Well, Director Pompeo has gone farther than many other previous directors, perhaps all of them, in being a political spokesman, not a senior intelligence advisor to the president on a variety of controversial issues, not the least of which has been Trump's predicament in dealing with the allegations of collusion with the Russians. So I wouldn't necessarily take the statement from the director as anything more at this point than a policy statement. I think the unfortunate thing here is that we have to assess this initiative against the backdrop of an administration that has essentially demonstrated over the space of almost a year and a half that it has neither policies nor, it would appear, the patience to come up with them to deal with any of the issues that it's put forward as priorities for the United States. The Middle East, Jared Kushner's leadership in a peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis going nowhere. China, the announcement when Trump went to China that there would be a new dialogue, it's moribund. Europe, basically incoherent policy towards our allies. We witnessed the trade mess that's been created by Trump's decision against the advice of half of his advisors to slap across-the-board tariffs on steel and aluminum. So with that as a backdrop, when you look at this literal surprise in the Oval Office 2 days ago, you have to ask yourself the question, on what basis do we see this as a strategic step by the president? Or, as you suggested a moment ago in your comment, where does it fit in Trump's reality TV version of the United States presidency? I would put a very, very heavy emphasis on the need for anyone who is going to begin negotiations with the North Koreans on our priority issue, which is North Korea's capability to deliver a nuclear weapon on an ICBM, very heavy emphasis on putting that problem in the broader context that it belongs in, and that is the U.S. role in maintaining stability on the peninsula and the U.S. role in East Asia. It's a very complicated question to negotiate with the North Koreans on the nuclear issue alone, but we have to approach it carefully because what the president says and does is going to have implications for how we're perceived by Japan, which is our most crucial ally in Asia, by how we're perceived by others in Southeast Asia with whom we are seeking to shore up our alliance relationships, by how we're perceived by potential adversaries, to include the Russians, which frankly have not been in our corner on the North Korean nuclear issue, and the Chinese, who are obviously conflicted on this question because their strategic interests in Korea differ from ours. In other words, if Trump goes to wherever he plans to go, the DMZ or some other location, in order to have this conversation, his grandiose gestures or statements, if they occur, absent any substantive underpinning on the whole range of questions that are part of our role in maintaining stability in that region, absent a coherent policy behind his remarks, could have very significant destabilizing consequences, undermining confidence in U.S. credibility in the region in ways that, frankly, we have not seen in 70 years. So, really, I would not be, getting to the heart of the issue from my point of view unless I said to you, we need to make sure that a president that goes to this kind of meeting, if it occurs, has been fully prepared and fully grounded in these broader issues. This isn't theater. This is a complicated problem made even more complex by the nature of this administration and its already dubious credibility. And it's one that can't be solved in a single meeting. There is no big deal that's going to take care of this question on the peninsula.
And, of course, Donald Trump has covered his best by saying, I may leave fast or we may sit down and make the greatest deal in the world. But if he does leave fast, I think that would be a catastrophe, and we'd be worse off, because what's Kim going to do when he's got egg on his face? That's when he gets dangerous. And again, I'm speaking with Kent Harrington, a former senior CIA analyst who served as the National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and as Chief of Station in Asia. Now, when you mentioned about the real problem, which is that North Korea can now threaten the United States with nuclear weapons, it's not a totally closed case in terms of what we, at least what's been in the public domain. But it looks as though, I mean, the whole North Korean regime is the ultimate Potemkin village. Let's face it. You have a defector at the DMZ recently running across getting shot, a soldier, and when they, try and patch him up at the hospital, they find out he's got a tapeworm halfway across the Pacific. I mean, this is really my understanding is that the reason that they've been able to get these missiles to get to the range that they have, we're still talking about 1960s missile technology. These are old-fashioned liquid-propelled rockets. And the way that he got them was they found a whole bunch of rocket motors from the 1960s sitting on a floor in a factory in Ukraine. And I don't know what the number are, but my understanding is that there may be bought between 10 and 20 of these surplus old rocket motors, which enable him to get to this threshold. So is that what he's got? Is he got deterrence on the cheap?
Well, it certainly makes sense to me based on much of the news that's come out about the North Korean program over the last several years, that help from Russian-related technologists and Russian hardware undoubtedly was part of what led the North Koreans to achieve their successes. It's also quite clear that they have built a very sophisticated outreach to acquire clandestinely necessary technologies, which aren't just simply hardware, but it's the software and the related capabilities to guide, to design, and then to operate systems which, while they may be dated in their core architecture, are still quite sophisticated. And last but not least, I would not underestimate, despite the nature of the North Korean economy and the extraordinary suffering that has been imposed on the people by an obviously authoritarian and repressive regime, the capability of North Korea to endure, both as a political elite, i.e. the Kim family, to keep its grip on power, and second, as a country that has proven over decades it's able to absorb a great deal of punishment, however unevenly we apply it when it comes to things like sanctions, and still continue to operate and indeed achieve goals like this missile and nuclear capability. I would caution also that in assessing what we can do about the North, we need to predicate our policies, our approach, on a certain reality. There is no question that the future is not on the Kim dynasty's side. At the same time, we need to be mindful of the need to maintain the balance on the peninsula that has prevented a war for 70 years. We need to be mindful of the fact that this is a regime that is very difficult to analyze. It's not irrational. It hasn't gone off the deep end in trying to provoke a conflict. And we have to have a way to deal with the fact that it's not just the United States that's threatened by the North Korean nuclear capability. It's our primary ally in Asia, that's Japan. It's South Korea, with a population that is extraordinarily talented and wrapped into the global economy. And it's a world trading system, the better part of two-thirds of which flows through East Asia as a result of its role in the world economy. We are not here to solve a problem, as our president so often suggests he can do with just simply a wink and a nod. We're here to manage this problem to a solution. And any other approach, quite frankly, is not just reality TV, it's hucksterism. So for a president who has now set himself up, as some have very correctly suggested, to include the professor with whom you just talked, for the possibility of a dramatic failure, I think it's time to look in the mirror and say, we've got to get serious about being, one, honest with the American people and others in the world about the complexity of this issue and what we're going to do to deal with it rationally. And number two, the duration of the challenge that we face in dealing with it, both in negotiating and in maintaining the kind of pressure on this particular regime that's going to keep it constrained in what it can do and what it can create in terms of weaponry to threaten our allies as well as us.
Well, in the last 30 seconds, it would seem that, you know, if Trump succeeds, then the North Korean people lose. But I suppose for all of us, that's a price we're prepared to pay if there's any possibility of constraining the possibility that nuclear missiles can land down on most American cities. So that's just in closing, that seems to be the bargain here, right?
Well, the fact is, as I would suggest, almost a generation worth of wars in the Near East should have taught us by now, we need to have a realistic idea of what our objectives should be. And if we're talking about regime change, that's one thing. If we're talking about dealing with arms control issues and with denuclearization in a very complex, difficult, challenging, and dangerous geopolitical environment, which is the Korean Peninsula and East Asia in which it fits, then we need to think about how we're going to go about it in a very methodical and professional way, with the ultimate objective, hopefully, of creating a world where not only for the Koreans, but for the rest of East Asia, there's both a more stable environment and the chance for those people to prosper.
Well, Kent Harrington, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. Enjoyed it.
And again, I've been speaking with Kent Harrington, who's a former senior CIA analyst who served as the National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and as Chief of Station in Asia. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into how Stormy Daniels may be breaking her NDA with Trump and how the American legal system may not survive Donald Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nina Burley, who's the national politics correspondent at Newsweek. Her latest book is The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox, which was a New York Times bestseller. She has an article at Newsweek, Stormy Breaks Trump's Favorite Legal Tactic, the NDA. And she has the cover article at Newsweek, The Star-Mangled Banner, Can the American Legal System Survive Donald Trump? Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Burley.
Thank you.
And your cover article raises a question, which I think is at the heart of what's going on here with the Trump and the Mueller investigation. Trump is not, to say the least, he's not your normal president. I don't know whether you saw the rally he did in Pennsylvania on Saturday night, but it was pretty unhinged. But in general, he's schooled by Roy Cohn. He's a slash-and-burn, take-no-prisoners type who uses the legal system proactively as a weapon.
and turns the tables on anybody that would try to sue him. And we certainly will get into that with Stormy Daniels, although it looks like she may actually be one of the few people that may lay a glove on him. But let's we last spoke when you did a piece on the Al Franken story of how a kind of right-wing hit job was done on Al Franken. There were some problems with that story. Some of it was retracted. I just wanted to set the record straight just briefly, if we could.
Yeah, just to set the record straight, we reported that a political botnet went after Al Franken simultaneously with Roger Stone tweeting that Al Franken's time in the barrel was coming. We later learned that after some challenges, we looked at our source. We couldn't verify his allegations that this botnet was political. A lot of these botnets are commercial, and it wasn't. It doesn't appear that the botnet was only aimed at Al Franken, and that it may have been just commercial. And since we couldn't confirm that, we retracted it. And I apologize for it because I did not fact-check it with my usual IT sources. It was President's Day, and I just put it up online and didn't fact-check it, and it was an error on my part. So we just took it down rather than have the continued attacks on it, and it is there's no doubt that there was a right wing hit on Al Franken that started with Roger Stone bringing forward Leanne Tweeden, but the online activity that was part of the story that I wrote is not verifiably connected to the political activity.
But the activity happened. There's no question about Roger Stone's
fault. Yeah, there's no question. There was a botnet. There were a bunch of fake tweets about Al Franken.
Right.
But that botnet also was tweeting a lot of other things. And
right.
It may have just been trying to capitalize on the trend of anti-Al Franken. So these things are very complicated. And when I report on these, you know, internet-related digital things, I usually have a number of IT experts involved in looking at it. And in this case, I just didn't do that. And the source wasn't, it was kind of flaked out. So we retracted it.
So let's turn to the story that you have, the cover article at Newsweek, the star-mangled banner, Can the American Legal System Survive Donald Trump? Obviously, Donald Trump is not famous for hiring quality people. That's a given, and he's a cheapskate. And I'm wondering about Michael Cohen, his lawyer. If you watch television lately, you see the lawyer for Stormy Daniels, who is really sharp, I must admit. He's really quite impressive. And it feels like Cohen is pretty hapless. I mean, he had to take the fall to say that he made the payment to Stormy Daniels, and he actually transferred it from his home equity line. The bank flagged it as a problem. And now it looks as if Stormy Daniels and the lawyer have some traction with the breaking this non-disclosure agreement that would then mean that she could go public with details about what happened with her and Donald Trump. And as we know, of course, this all happened a week before the election.
That's true. Well, to your first point, does Donald Trump hire, is he a cheapskate, and does he hire substandard legal help? Look, Michael Cohen worked for him at the Trump Organization for 10 years at least. He is one of many, many, many lawyers that have worked for Trump in New York. So I don't think that you can say that he has hired substandard lawyers. I think that Michael Cohen was in the habit of doing these dirty jobs for him. And at this point, you know, after the election of Donald Trump, all of these people came under the microscope. And Michael Cohen is one of the people who was hauled down to testify before the intelligence committees. He's been looped into the Steele dossier. And, you know, he is just a New York lawyer. He's not one of the best New York lawyers. He was a Trump Organization lawyer. So it's pretty clear that he's going to take a fall here, and that he may have already, you know, recognized that at some point. As you know, he took a book. He's I think, signed a pretty big bucks book deal. And I think he recognizes that that's where he's headed. Now, as far as these the tactic of silencing people with NDAs and of gagging settlement orders in courts, that's part of the Trump tactic. And that leads to, you know, the idea, the tactics, the playbook, the Trump playbook is it's very familiar to people in New York, and it involves these silencing agreements, NDAs, settlement gags, or confidential settlement agreements. I see that right now. I'm working on an article about Ivanka Trump, and Ivanka Trump settled one of the lawsuits against her just recently, and it never made the news. It just went straight to, you know, she was being sued over a shoe design, and suddenly the lawsuit ended, and nobody will talk about it. So this is a Trump tactic. Let's see, NDA, silencing, run out the clock. You know, with Trump and Mueller. I mean, the reason I wrote the story is that they're, you know, the progressives and the resistance and the anti-Trumpers on the right as well, like Rick Wilson. I'm talking about everyone, the anti-Trumpers on left and right, right, the progressives, the resistance, have all pinned their hopes on the legal system to bring down Donald Trump. And what we're seeing now is that the Mueller investigation has dragged on and on and on, and people are wondering, well, where's the beef? Where's the collusion? And, you know, the thing I looked at was Donald Trump's career, 40 years of business career, where he manipulated the legal system. He uses litigation to harass. He's managed to evade 4 grand juries. This is the 5th, mostly by running out the clock, sometimes by ratting out on other people. And he has managed to get away with a lot. Now, whether or not the things he's gotten away with can be called actual crimes, I mean, we do have tax lawyers looking at some of the things he's done, and I have them in my story saying it looks like criminal tax fraud. But the fact is, whatever he's done, he's managed to slide away. And now he's in this position under the microscope. You have Mueller investigating, interviewing all of his associates. His associates are fleeing. They have to hire their own lawyers. And so it looks like he's in the fight of his life, and that the American legal system is catching up to him. But I talk to a lot of lawyers on both sides, conservatives and progressives and non-aligned lawyers, who think that maybe the legal system isn't the way that he's going to be brought down, and that, in fact, it's going to fall to politics and policy, politics being obviously the 2018 midterms or the 2020 election, and policy being when those new people come into Congress, and if Congress turns Democratic, or if for some reason the Republicans who control Congress suddenly wake up and decide they want to follow the law and want to pay attention to the Constitution, that will result in policies being changed and statutes being written that will say, put the emoluments clause into a statute. The emoluments clause that has to do with, say, conflicts of his many, many, many conflicts of interest that at the moment are not illegal, but are that have the appearance of a conflict of interest, which prior presidents would have avoided, but which this one does not avoid because he doesn't feel shame about it. So the issue is whether or not the law can catch up to him. And I think it's an issue that people have ignored, and they don't want to admit that this is the way it's headed. But I think it is headed this way. And I think it is, you know, if you talk to people at Common Cause, the guys who filed they asked the FEC and the Justice Department to look into the Stormy Daniels hush money because it is illegal to do that. I mean, John Edwards went to trial over hush money that was paid to his mistress, if you remember that.
Sure.
This is an illegal act. You can't take campaign money, you can't take donor money and put it into a hush project during a campaign. And that's what they did. So, you know, even that lawyer who ran that up to the DOJ and the FEC, even he says it may not be that the law catches up to him. It's very much more likely that the public policy will have to be changed, and that it's going to happen only once the politics changes in this country.
But Nina Burley, aren't the Republicans on board the strategy with Trump to run out the clock? My sense is
absolutely that
they don't want Mueller's report to come out until after November, and that they
absolutely and they're into run out the clock, and that's another one of his, part of the Trump playbook in New York was to get a politician or a bunch of politicians to do his bidding. And see, what you see here is that he has Devin Nunes doing that for him at the House Intelligence Committee. And they will, you know, they're working for him. And they will try to run out the clock, certainly.
And the, of course, impeachment itself, if the Democrats take the House generates the case. It is a political process, not a legal process.
Exactly. And there's, you know, the jury's still out on whether, I mean, the legal consensus, if you listen to people like Preet Bharara, they say the legal consensus is that a president cannot be charged with a crime. Now, interestingly, the New York Times ferreted out of the National Archives a year or two ago, or maybe more recently than that, that Ken Starr, President Clinton's private, or what do you call it, the special counsel, special investigator, Ken Starr had written an opinion saying that he believed presidents could be charged, but that document was buried in the National Archives until the New York Times pulled it up. So that's another conversation that will be had. But again, that kind of question is a clock running tactic in itself, because to run that question up to the Supreme Court again is going to take years. So they run out the clock. There are many, many, many ways that they can run out the clock.
Well, but back to my point about Trump not getting quality people, we know that the national security establishment wanted to have nothing to do with him. 50 of the top Republican national security, you know, the pantheon of experienced officials in the American government, wrote a letter wanting nothing to do with Trump. When you look at the kind of people, when you look at Manafort and Carter Page and Papadopoulos, I mean, the most outrageous one of all, of course, is this guy George Nader, who set up the back channel with the Russians, with Eric Prince, the mercenary army guy, and the MBZ, as he's called, of the Emirates, the Crown Prince of the Emirates. They met in the Seychelles. Well, George Nader, for God's sake, is a child molester who was arrested and jailed in Jordan. No wonder Mueller's been
having
a rolling.
Only the best. Only the best people on his staff.
Right, exactly. That's what he
keeps
saying.
That was the promise.
Right. So do you think the fact that he's got a bunch of bottom feeders there, that's where he's vulnerable? Because they're all rolling.
Well, obviously he is vulnerable through. But again, like, are they going to link Manafort or any of those other guys directly to him? I mean, I don't know. I think that, again, the vulnerability is just as it was with Berlusconi. When you had Berlusconi, I mean, this is an analogy that I think is apt. Berlusconi similarly was accused of all sorts of larcenous behavior, and, you know, the law was nibbling away at him in Italy for a long time. And what brought him down? The girl. In the end, it was the girl. The 18-year-old girl.
Right.
And I think that in this case, I always thought that it's going to be a woman thing with him, as it always is in American politics, with Clinton.
Well,
you know,
then,
you can get away with a lot. But right. that's when they start to go. And I think that, you know, this NDA and the fact that they paid her off, that is patently illegal, and it put John Edwards in the dock.
Right.
Right. I mean, this is an illegal act, and they can't hide that it was an illegal act unless, I mean, I don't know what Michael Cohen's going to say that he was doing, but the Wall Street Journal has sources who say he was complaining that he wasn't paid back. And when they put him on the stand and he has to say, why did he think he was going to be paid back? You know what I mean? It's
right.
All going to come. It's
sure.
All going to come down.
Sure, and he communicated with Stormy Daniels' lawyer via the Trump Organization's email.
Of course, he did.
So let's in the last couple of minutes, then back to Stormy Daniels. In this legal document, it does list Trump listed a whole bunch of stuff that he wants suppressed of hers, and it covers a wide. Is that just boilerplate legal? But it seems like you're talking about photos, videotapes, text, emails. Is there a history between these two? Do you think that that's what is at stake here, right? That she'll go on TV and just tell all, and it'll all be
Yes and no. I mean, I don't know. who knows what she all what all she has. But I think it is boilerplate, and I think it probably is the way they write those contracts, because he was probably. I mean, if you read Michael Wolff's book, Bannon says there were 100 women that they probably wrote these contracts more than once.
Right.
And so I think they're and also wrote them for other reasons. And so I think that's boilerplate. One of the lawyers who read it had this interesting theory where they thought Trump's lawyer had that the boilerplate indicated that Trump copyrighted and owned everything that she was going to say or publish about him. And that's also, I think, a Trump tactic to make your females into products and brandable. And that's something that he was doing with her. If you read the In Touch Weekly article, the transcript of the, I don't know what more she can say about him, because that In Touch Weekly transcript goes on for pages and pages,
right,
where you learn that he's afraid of sharks and all sorts of things you didn't want to know about him. But that at that one point where she says, in fact, their relationship maintained contact with him because he kept holding out the carrot of putting her on his TV show. And so that's part of what he was doing. You know, I'll brand you, I'll make you a star. And that's what he's doing with all the women that he's engaged with. I've just finished a book on Trump women, which is going to come out in the summer. And you'll learn more about that in my book.
You mean an encyclopedia?
No, it's just about the family women. You could write the encyclopedia.
Right.
It's just about his family.
Right. Well, let's just in the last minute here then. I think the lawyer for Stormy Daniels said at least 10 people have volunteered to pay $1 million. Because, you know, in the contract, if she breaks anything...
Yes, I saw that.
If she breaks any part of the contract, she gets charged $1 million per revelation. What do you think of that? I mean, he said they haven't taken up the offer, but there are obviously people out there that inquiring minds want to spend $1 million to find out, right?
Well, I mean, it just goes to... it's just an indicator of how loathed he is, that there would be people that would be willing to pay that kind of money, and how intensely emotional response to him has become, how intense it is that people would fork over that kind of money.
Well, Nina Belli, I look forward to your book, and let's stay in touch.
Absolutely. Take care, Ian.
You too. Thank
Bye.
You. Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Nina Belli, who's the national politics correspondent at Newsweek. Her latest book is The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox, which was a New York Times bestseller. And she has an article at Newsweek, Stormy Breaks Trump's Favorite Legal Tactic, the NDA. And she has the cover article at Newsweek, The Star Mangled Banner, Can the American Legal System Survive Donald Trump? And again, I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.